Meeting of the interim committee meeting of the House Veterans and Emergency Services. And the...
Yeah, I'll gavel in as well. Thank you, Jean, for being here this morning. And I think you have something special to announce, however.
Well, it has come to my attention that we are celebrating a birthday today.
Ooh.
Uh-oh. Happy birthday, Director Willis. Do we have anyone who would care to lead in any song? Not me.
I think Tom Mann would like to.
Come on, Tom.
I'm not seeing any volunteers. You know, usually there's someone who has that capability, is willing to. And if not, we'll wish you a happy birthday.
We can't even ask him what number it is.
You kill me, right?
That would be impolite.
You can ask.
Rep Stigler, did you have a question?
No, ma'am.
Not me.
Recognizing.
I know.
And Senator Schrader also has some exciting things to tell us about. So, happy birthday, Jim.
And I know. Thank you, Jim. Really, truly, happy birthday. Thank you for all your hard work. I know that you've been in D.C. visiting with Mr. Shinseki about our programs here. And I had the opportunity yesterday to be with Mrs. Obama. As congressional spouses, she pulls together very small lunches with a number of us. And besides the fact that Congressman Schrader is her brother's congressman, which I mentioned to her, I never miss an opportunity to talk about what we are doing here in the state of Oregon in terms of our models for reintegration of our military families, how great our VA is, how we're working with everybody across the continuum, our guard, our reserve folks, and indeed the high level of interest the Army Reserve has shown in getting a family center set up here in the great state of Oregon. So very receptive, and so I did ask her, I said, can I tell folks one more time that yes, you will be coming to Oregon? And she assured me that Oregon was on her places to come and visit. So hopefully with Director Willis's help and Tom's help, we can showcase the great work we're doing here, because not only is it national, I think statewide work, I think we've got some pretty good national models here. So fun times.
That would be exciting.
Yeah, it will
be. We'd be very happy to play host.
So at this point in time, we're going to be running through the agenda. We are starting with the Senate piece of this, and what we first have on our agenda is an informational meeting, which is an overview of traumatic brain injury symptoms and treatment, and we do have invited testimony from Mr. Willis and Jack Heim. So, gentlemen, and Mr. Mann, I believe, is also going to be helping out.
So much for the technical.
Do we need to get somebody from a safe claim in here?
He's going to get whacked on the head.
Yeah, whatever happened to just a nice little old tripod?
An easel.
What was wrong with that?
Technical difficulty. Can we say PowerPoint is difficult?
I thought this was simpler than setting up a PowerPoint.
I used to love technology advancement. Be careful, because you're not going to walk into the box of chocolate. Certainly,
this
we're all going to realize how old we are. How's my brain?
I'm doing great.
So for anyone listening at home, I don't know if the cameras are catching this challenge of setting up an easel, but we are working on it.
We may have to go back to PowerPoint, don't you think?
We may have to return to PowerPoint, yes.
It's a pretty fancy easel, actually, isn't it?
It's, here we go.
Nothing simple anymore.
Quite nice once you get it all put
together.
There we
go.
Thank you.
Very good. Oh, that's okay.
Thank you to our able staff.
Okay, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Willis, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today to thank the chairs and committee members for inviting me to discuss our veterans and traumatic brain injury. As you well know, traumatic brain injury, or TBI, is one of two signature injuries occurring in the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq. The other one is post-traumatic stress disorder. Many of our service members in this conflict experience some level of TBI due to what is called blast exposure from various combat actions. A large number of our veterans experience TBI due to exposure to improvised explosive devices, which are routinely used against our troops in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Generally, they come in three forms, which I apologize is not part of my testimony, but they are either hidden in a building or along a roadside. They're borne by an individual, or they're vehicle-borne. Whether hit directly by an IED or affected by the blast concussion of the bomb, service members can be affected by mild, moderate, or severe TBI. IEDs are not the only type of concussive exposures our troops face. Blast concussion occurs from rocket-propelled grenades, or RPGs, mortars, and any other type of explosive. Also, our warriors can face TBI exposure in any situation where they have head trauma. For example, if a soldier receives an incoming rifle round that's stopped by his or her Kevlar helmet, the concussion of the round could cause a level of TBI. Other examples would be if a soldier simply hits his or her head while diving for cover or is injured in a vehicle accident. In both these cases, the soldier may experience TBI. Now, according to a study, and I believe that you've been given a copy of a congressional report, which is very new. It's November of 2009. But according to this study, nearly 30% of all combat injured who were treated at Walter Reed between 2003 and 2005 were brain injuries. So that's 30% of all of our combat injuries were brain injuries. According to the Congressional Research Office, as many as 20% of Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom were veterans who experienced some level of TBI. The symptoms of this condition include headaches, lightheadedness, blurred vision, bad taste in the mouth, slurred speech, confusion, dizziness, ringing in the ears, fatigue, and lethargy. TBI can also share symptoms of PTSD such as insomnia, depression, anxiety, and memory problems. Approximately 60% of patients with moderate head injuries make positive recoveries. An estimated 25% will be left with a moderate degree of disability. Death or persistent vegetative state will be the outcome in about 7 to 10% of the cases, and the remainder of the patients will have a severe degree of disability. The military and the United States Department of Veterans Affairs have been aggressively screening soldiers who have served in combat theaters for TBI. Soldiers who would have died on the battlefield in previous conflicts are living today due to technological and medical advances. However, while more that are living through extreme trauma, the result is more veterans are returning home with more severe disabilities such as TBI. In April of 2007, the VA implemented a policy requiring TBI screening for all OEF-OIF veterans who had not been previously diagnosed with TBI. Prior to that date, no TBI screening was required. The screening is a four-part process. The soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coast Guard members, whoever, are asked to describe the event, describe the immediate symptoms, describe the worsening symptoms, and then describe their current symptoms. If a veteran responds positively to any of the above screening areas, the veteran is referred for follow-up testing. Having a positive screen for TBI does not necessarily mean the veteran has TBI. The screening is designed to be sensitive to catch all possible TBI cases, and refer them for follow-up to ensure appropriate care is provided. As of January 2009, 50,000 veterans have screened positive for TBI. 30,000 completed their follow-up medical appointments. Of those, only 50% have been diagnosed with TBI, according to Congressional Research Office, or excuse me, Congressional Research Service. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs trains all state and county veteran service officers in TBI symptomology and assessment. During the initial interview, VSOs question veterans as to their exposure to blast concussions and symptoms the veteran may be experienced from the event. In many cases, our veterans have experienced multiple blast traumas from IEDs and RPGs. If a veteran screens positive for blast exposure and TBI symptomology, VSOs write claims for disability compensation and encourage the veteran to seek treatment for their condition. All OEF, OIF veterans have 5 years free health care from the VA. So our VSOs help enroll these veterans in VA healthcare, in the VA healthcare system, and further help the veteran get appointments for appropriate care. It's important as part of this testimony that you all know that when the April 2007 implementation occurred to require screening of all OEF, OIF veterans, it was because that up to that time and following the attacks on our country of 9/11/2001, those people having gone to the theaters both in Afghanistan and Iraq were not being screened on their way home either by DOD or by the VA. As a result, we had and still have a large number of veterans who served in theater who until this decision by the federal VA had not been screened. So we are seeking these veterans to come in for their screening, and then if they have the symptomology associated with TBI, that we write a disability claim for them, and we enroll them in the VA health care to which they are entitled. With me today is Jack Himes, who can now go into greater detail as to how the VA healthcare system treats and manages TBI cases.
Mr. Willis, I believe, yes. Representative Cowan
has
a question.
One question before we move on?
Sure.
Because it's timely. Thank you. You mentioned that all veterans from these conflicts are entitled to 5 years of medical care. In the case of those individuals who might not have been screened until this particular change in 2007, where does the 5 years start? From the time of service or from the time of screening, or is it a secondary process of going through a disability determination and getting a different sort of eligibility?
Let me answer the, Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me answer the last part first. The disability has nothing to do with the length of their eligibility for the health care. But it has everything to do with the long-term use of the health care once they've been assessed to having a disability. They're probably going to be in the health care for the rest of their life. In terms of when the clock starts, initially it was on return from theater. But I'm going to pass the buck, I'm sorry to tell you, to my good friend Jack Himes, because he will know and I don't. I know that when you return from theater, you've got 5 years. I also know that 5 years is not a specific number, because if that person is enrolled in VA health care and all of a sudden the last day of the fifth year comes up, they're certainly not going to kick them out of the health care system.
Thank you. If we could address that as we go along, because I was just thinking about the individual who may have come home from theater in 2004,
right,
but not been screened and been identified until 2007. And
okay. Madam Chair, may I ask a question? Mm-hmm. Sherry Stock, who is the director of the Traumatic Brain Injury Group in the state of Oregon, is in the audience. And I hope you address the bigger picture, because there are probably Vietnam veterans, probably Korean veterans, World War II veterans who are still suffering from traumatic brain injury, and they've been misdiagnosed. Now, my concern is, or my interest is, whether or not there's an attempt to identify those people and to then give them the need that they the help that they need through the Veterans Administration. So if you could address that, that would be good.
In as part of your
well, Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, let me just speak specifically from ODVA's standpoint and our service officers and your county veteran service officers that are in all of your districts. We are still seeing persons suffering with what now we call traumatic brain injury from World War II, from Korea, from Vietnam, and they are afforded the same opportunity for disability claims to be filed on their behalf as in previous time. And to just expand on that just a little bit more, in World War I, they had what they called shell shock. Mm-hmm. In World War II, they had battle fatigue. Mm-hmm. You know, and then in each era, and it went back to the Civil War, where it was called the soldier's disease. And in the end, it's always the same thing. It's TBI and PTSD and, or both. That's what it ends up being. So I can just assure you that regardless of the conflict in which the person served, from our state anyway, they have the same ability as do these young men and women coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq to be, one, represented, and two, given the medical care, which Jack is just about to talk about. I hope that
thank you.
That. And you're up.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Himes. And up until 2 weeks ago, when I retired from the VA after 14 years, 12 of which was Director of Mental Health and Neurosciences at the VA, covering 65,000 veterans in the basically the northwest section of the fine state of Oregon. Previously, I was unable to testify before this group or any group because there's a prohibition from central office for veteran VA employees to testify. So I'm now free to testify.
Interesting.
Let me, Senator Morissette, if I don't get to your question, make sure I get to it.
Yeah.
Being retired, I don't also have to use PowerPoints anymore. And I'd like to use a flip chart to basically do some education in TBI, if that's what pleases the committee. Jim, can I borrow a mic? So, TBI, or traumatic brain injury, is defined as a blow, a jolt, or a penetrating injury to the head that disrupts normal function. Normally, when I'm in this size group, I ask, how many people have had their bell rung? Football, just in the committee, it's over a third.
Really?
Now we're up to a half. So keep that in perspective. And all of that we knew about TBI was from basically auto accidents and football injuries, right? Bike injuries, that kind of thing. There's three classes of TBI. Kind of your basic, which is when you lose consciousness less than 30 minutes, moderate, which is less than 6 hours, and severe, which is greater than 6 hours. So I've had two bike accidents, one with moderate and one with basic. The reason I say that is because people recover. Virtually 100% of your basic TBI recover. And that's true for OAF, OIF. It was true for Representative Matthews when he was in the football injury. As Director Willis said, 60% of moderate recovery. VA experience is more like 80% there. And the breakdowns are 80%, you know, kind of basic TBI, 10%, and 10%. with OEF and OIF and in Vietnam, and it's usually black. And one of the problems we have in TBI, both at the research end and in the treatment end and in the diagnosis end, is that there's so many ways to get to injure the brain. And let me just walk you through how that happens. So I'm standing here, and there's a blast against that wall there. The first thing that happens to me is there's a concussive blast, and I'm thrown back. And even though I have this, Mr. Evans? 8-pound helmet. Are they up to 8 pounds now, General? 8-pound helmet on. This part of my brain is pretty plastic. It's encased too. So the first thing that happens, you got to remember, a brain is like a semi-cooked cauliflower sitting in a hard shell. And behind your eyebrow is a little ridge on the other side. So the first thing that happens is my brain is thrown back, and then it bounces forward. It's doing the jello effect inside. So one thing that happens is some what we call neuronal tearing. The other thing that happens is when I'm thrown back, it's not necessarily straight back. It can be an instant hard twist. So again, the water balloon and the shell twist, and there's neuronal damage then. And I just lost my speech for the rest of it. Then when I'm falling backwards, I land, and because I have the 8-pound helmet, which somewhat protects me, it also gives more acceleration because of that weight. So my head whacks and whacks hard. You see this on when you movies and TV. The next injury can be, let's say, the brick from that wall flying at a very rapid rate, hitting my helmet. So I'm up to 3 or 4 now. The other thing that happens, and this gets back to Senator Morrison, I've got huge armor on. And that's the difference between this war and other wars. So my Kevlar protects me from a brick hitting me here, a shrapnel hitting me here. But my leg may get lacerated. Let's say I get a lot of blood loss from this leg. That causes, blood loss causes another brain injury. And then the last thing that can happen is the brain swells within this cavity, mostly again on these, moderate to severe. And that is another insult to the brain. So in one event, I've had 6 different hits to my brain, and to try to decipher now which one caused me to have dizziness and which one caused me to have depression and which one caused me to have anxiety, it's hard to sort all that out. One of the good news I'm going to present today is that both the armed forces and the VA have invested huge amounts of money in researching TBI that didn't exist before. We have 4, when the war started, we had 2 neuropsychologists. We now have 5 neuropsychologists, 4 are involved in research, and 2 postdocs involved in research. So, and most of their work happens to be on what Director Willis said is the overlay between PTSD and TBI.
Madam Chair, may I ask?
Yes.
The first one that you described is the whiplash.
No, that's the one you fall.
Okay. Now, the woman who died on the ski slopes about a year ago had traumatic brain injury. She had whiplash. And it caused bleeding in the brain, and if she had been attended to immediately, she would have lived.
That's a swelling, yeah.
Yeah. So is whiplash included?
That's the whack back.
Yeah, yeah.
So getting back to your question, if I can just take a side road here. And I may need help from the back row here. In this war, the injury to death rate is 16 to 1. So there's 16 injuries for every death.
Mm-hmm.
In Vietnam, so it was 5 to 1-ish. 5 to 1. World War II, it was 3 to 1. World War I, it was 2 to 1. And basically, the Civil War was 1 to 1. So there may have been huge numbers in Vietnam who were getting TBI if they died. They didn't survive. Now, with what, you know, getting them out quick, getting them to Germany quick, getting them to Walter Reed quick, the survivability is huge. Because of the Kevlar, it's huge. And now we're seeing far more. But you're right. Are there folks out there from Vietnam and World War II with TBI? Most definitely.
Well, battlefield attention is important also for some forms of TBI, because if the relieving the pressure on the brain that otherwise would cause death if you wait for 5 hours.
So 15 to 20% while in Iraq and Afghanistan meet the criteria for TBI. And again, you look at the numbers we've had in this room with what life throws at us. It seems like a high number because it's such a concentrated time. It is. But it's also what life presents to us. But I don't want to diminish the importance. And then when you talk about recovery, it's also a mixed bag. It's hard to just say you have the football helmet injury and he has recovery, because here you're mixing trauma, significant trauma, both bodily and emotionally, with the event. And then you get this almost synergy, so it's hard to separate that out. Is that clear? Okay. So there's all sorts of symptoms. You got the physical symptoms, which are the headache, dizziness, pain, low energy, and sleep. Only the dizziness is, every one of these I'm mentioning also refers to PTSD. Dizziness doesn't. Let's go to emotional. And these, just to give you an idea of the overlay, anxiety has a 55%. Those having TBI, 55% have anxiety. 63% have depression. Irritability, flat affect, emotional dysregulation. Again, all the things you get with PTSD. So it's, again, hard to separate out, getting back to Senator Morris's question. Then you have the cognitive problems. Memory, 59%. Attention, 71%. Word finding, executive functioning, and information processing are evidence, but also present in PTSD. And then you have behavioral issues, impulsivity, disinhibition, talking all the time, hyperverbal, and apathy. Again, things you see in folks with PTSD. And 44% of people with TBI said that their events were traumatic. Well, no kidding. If it was me, it would be 100%. So let's talk a second about how they get discovered. When the first group came back from, of our National Guard came back, General Caldwell, they went to Colorado Fort
Carson.
Fort Carson was the first fort that started screening for TBI. And that's where the first research was coming out, was out of Fort Carson. So the first place they get is upon return to country, there's a screen. Then they, but any guy returns, or gal who returns to country, is saying, I'm not going to tell them anything that's wrong with me. Why?
Get held over.
So they don't get picked up there. 90 to 120 days later, when they're coming back for the National Guard, they go through what's called post-deployment health reassessment clinic. Again, ask the four questions. When they come to the VA, they go to a post-deployment clinic. They're asked the same questions. And most importantly, when they're established with their primary care physician, where you have relationships. Because, you know, when you think of your own healthcare, what it's about relationship, relationship, relationship. They're asked annually. And it's with the primary care is where it usually shows up, because the wife's calling in and saying, he's inattentive, he's flat affect, you know, those kinds of things happen. So these all feed... When somebody comes into, we were talking about the guy who got transferred to, you know, quickly to Germany, then sent to Walter Reed. They either get sent to Walter Reed, Texas, or San Diego. And that's where polytrauma, where you have multiple things happening, are sent. When they're sent there, they are assigned in the VA what's called an angel. Somebody who's on call 24/7 for that family and that veteran in their area. And there's angels at Portland, Roseburg, and White City.
This is great.
The Portland one, of course, is the busiest. And there's now a staff of 5 doing that. So the angels track that person, and they usually are sent from, let's say, San Diego to Seattle first for an assessment, because that's where one of the 5 traumatic brain injury centers is. Another one's in Palo Alto. So we've got the West Coast pretty well covered. And from the post-deployment, they can come in and get assessed also. And now let's move to the actual treatment. They can come into a polytrauma clinic, where a team assesses them, a team with a psychiatrist, neuropsychologist, social worker, primary care who specializes in this, speech pathologist, occupational therapist, all sit around with the patient and the family and put together a treatment plan. So I've got to say, and hearing is also assessed, and vision. There's also a medical specialty called physiatry, which is the whole rehabilitation, which is also present. I've got to say I have no concerns about, and this is as a retiree, no concerns about how once a person enters the VA system, how they're treated and how much attention is given to them. There's 2 other pieces. Traumatic brain injury also causes other neurological damage. One is Parkinson's. Muhammad Ali, right? And the second is epilepsy. The Portland VA is one of 3 or 4 national centers for Parkinson's. So our vets get exceptionally good care for Parkinson's, and their families, I should add. And then the last piece is we just were awarded well over $1 million a year for an epilepsy center because of our Portland VA's epilepsy expertise. So as these people come in now with seizures or down the road are getting Parkinson's, the VA is there for them. Senator Morissette, did that answer your question?
Yeah.
And I'm open for any other questions.
May I follow up on that? I guess I'm still interested in the battlefield care of soldiers, and I understand how difficult it would be, but if they can identify a severe brain damage, bleeding in the brain that will cause death if it's not attended to, if they have ways of dealing with that.
First of all, they have battle buddies. That what's different in this war is that the guy with them are trained to stem bleeding. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I talked about the cut in the leg.
Yeah.
They know how to put on tourniquets, slap on bandages before the helicopter arrives to transport them to Balad, where they get that assessed. And they're in Germany and...
Longstuhl.
10 hours? 10 hours or less.
Is it less than that?
Less than that now. At least in the last 90 days. Yes.
It's quick. And then it gets sent to Walter Reed as appropriate. A good example was at the Washington Summit. We had a young man, loss of an arm, loss of an eye, burns 58%, TBI, went through the entire process of rehab through the Army down in Fort Hood. Entire process, he drove home, was involved in treatment with the VA for several months before he kind of came to. He was just kind of operating on automatic pilot, and then he kind of woke up and said, how did I get here? So this is some of the, even though he got the seal of approval that he was fine down there, he wasn't. So it just lets you know how little we know about this weird insult to this incredible organ we all have. Any other questions? Madam Chair?
Thank you. I need to take you back. I'm still struggling with understanding the point of eligibility, and particularly as you've gone through this development of recognition of TBI, that recognition might not come until after someone is home for a while and with their primary care physician and spousal intervention or whatever, and again going back to the 5 years of eligibility for medical care post-deployment, but if the problem isn't recognized until you're on year four of post-deployment...
You're covered.
And are you automatically covered? Because I'm impressed when you say that you had no real concerns once someone is entered into the system about the level of care they get. So I think what we hear out on the street is the difficulty of getting into the VA system, and I'm trying to figure out where that degree of automatic eligibility is, and then we won't talk about access.
So we have staff at the PDHRAs who are trying to get folks enrolled, and my understanding is that 100% will get enrolled now at that the first time they come back. So they'll be enrolled in the system. Their names will be entered. They're ready to go. And we can give them primary care appointments at the PDHRAs if they so desire. We're currently getting about 40-45% of returning OEF-OIF veterans into the VA, getting their care there. Are we missing a whole bunch? But that's 3-4 times where we got out of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So folks who need and the families are educated to see these, if this is happening, get your husband in or get your wife in or get your child in. And then if, let's say they don't, for some reason, don't find anybody within 5 years, don't seek help in 5 years, don't enroll, and a friend gets them to the county veteran service officer in Tillamook, and they can get them enrolled at that, through the disability process too. But the other thing that happens, quite frankly, is the other way they qualify is because TBI, a severe TBI,
makes a person difficult to hire and keep hired. So they quickly fall into passing the means test to get in. So the door is open. We try to make it attractive. We let the families know, but they have to, they'll sign to get in. They can get the card, but to get them to walk through the door, we don't have control of that, unfortunately.
Okay, thank you.
You can lead a horse to water. We try to make them thirsty. We have the trough right there.
I know we saw another question.
Yes.
And then I know that Senator Boquist wanted to add some information about the quickness of medical.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question would be, and thanks for all your effort and thanks for your work, my question is there anything being done on the front end to prevent these guys from having to self-identify? As an example, what documentation is provided, say, when there's a roadside bomb? You know, Representative Esquivel and I could be in the same vehicle. It could impact him differently. We could both be exposed at some point. Wouldn't that be documented along that mission to where we could look at that and say, there's potential for injury amongst this group of these soldiers, and try to get some frontline screening before we're asking them, is there anything wrong with you?
Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, here's my understanding in talking to the Department of Defense folks about that exact issue. The referrals, and it has to do with the need to screen early, the referrals from an IED incident are coming in that identifies those people in proximity of the explosion, and referral then to the frontline triage. And then from the frontline triage, those that need to go for more in-depth treatment. Now, prior to about 2006, 2007, that was not the case. It was the identifiable wounded were obviously triaged at the scene by combat medics and then moved out sometimes by helicopter, sometimes by land transportation, and then treated in addition. Now that we understand the mild, moderate and severe impacts, it's important to triage everyone. So my understanding from DOD is that's what they're doing now that they didn't do before.
Thank you.
And then later on, of course, as we've just explained and Jack talked about, we try to say to those people who've been in the theater and were missed from the screening opportunity, come on in. Don't wait until it gets worse. And then we'll do some disability counseling with you, file a claim, get you into the health care system, and get you treatment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Director Willis, so what you're basically saying is we're now tracking much more closely these incidents in one's record, and that would follow that individual in their record that they were, I don't know, let's say December 2nd, they were in such and such a place and they were involved in this kind of an incident. So then in the future when it comes up, we can kind of zero in on this. Is basically it's a more of a gathering of information and a database?
Representative, or Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, that's correct. And that's really as a result of the work of the Secretary of Defense, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Secretary of the VA, who have now developed a system, and I hope that it will be in place very shortly, where when you go into the military, you also go into the VA system. And it's intended to track you for life in terms of whatever happens to you in the military, including the registry of the incident in which you could have been involved, even to a mild degree, so that that is accessible first by DOD, if that's who's treating you, but secondly by the VA. The big problem has been among large federal agencies in more than just VA and DOD, unfortunately, that they were not sharing information. And now, and I think it has a lot to do with the fact that Secretary Shinseki is a former Chief of Staff of the Army and understands the system, and also was a patient of the VA following his wounds in Vietnam. He is an individual who understands the need to have connectivity between DOD and between the VA. And so I think what you're going to see, Representative Esquivel, is a patient-centric system that's focused on the individual and all of the data that has to do with whatever caused their injuries in a way that's never been done before. And I think we're going to do, I think both the DOD and the VA are going to do a better job in supporting our armed forces personnel as a result.
Follow up, Madam Chair. I think that's a very good idea, because when I was discovered that I had some problems from Agent Orange, the first question was, well, were you in country? Well, it seems to me that if they pulled up my record, they would know that I was in country. And then he said, well, were you in country? Well, yeah, how in country can you get? You know? And then he said, were you on a base? No, I slept in the jungle. You know, but he had no idea of actually where I had been, what I had been doing, or anything of that nature. But this is interesting that we should be able to track that, and I think it's very, very prudent of us to do so, because it gives us some kind of a data and a base to figure out what is happening to our veterans.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Escobar, I don't want to date your time of service.
No, it was back, it was in Gettysburg. It was the Battle of Gettysburg, yeah.
I mean, I know we're not talking the Civil War or anything here, but the service in Vietnam...
You were there with me, though.
Yes, I was. But the service in Vietnam, and many of you are aware of this, would show so many years or months in an overseas tour. Mm-hmm. And the only way you would know that person was serving in that theater of operation is to go down into the section of their discharge document, their DD Form 214, and if you saw a Vietnam campaign ribbon or a Vietnam service ribbon, then you might be able to figure out that they were in the theater. But they could have been in Thailand and still earned those same two ribbons. And they could have been temporary duty assignment and earned those same two ribbons. So it depends, what you're saying is, it depends on where were you, and the record wouldn't necessarily show that you were at Cam Ranh Bay, which clearly is in Vietnam and clearly was in an Agent Orange defoliant zone, which would expose you to that toxin. So what you're saying is, are we doing better? And the answer is yes, we are.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that because of Vietnam, which was our war, our era, and for many of us, we're actually seeing system-wide changes now in how we're dealing with our veterans in a way that hasn't been done before.
Madam Chair, that's the case, and it's long overdue.
Yeah.
It's long overdue.
I was going to ask Senator Boquist just to mention, because you had commented about some of the quickness of delivery systems now with medical. Can you enlighten us a little bit? I think you've got some very recent information.
For whatever reason, and let me preface here, so General Caldwell doesn't fall off his chair back there. For whatever reason, political or whatever, in the month of December, they released most of the data in part of the ongoing political debate for Afghanistan. And so the data for the month of December was released, along with a little bit more information. And anybody that's interested, I think I have the report upstairs. I'd be happy to share with the committee. In the month of December, there were 853 significant events involving an IED, RPG, or mortar attack. And just so you know, it's winter over there and it's snowy, so that's a whole lot of events. Corresponding to that, there was somewhere in the 950, 952, 953, air evacuations were flown during the same 30-day period. So that's people that were evacuated out. average time was down to, for evacuation out of country, was down to less than 8 hours. And that has more to do with probably not so much how great the system is. It's just freaking winter over there, and you got to get people out as fast as you can. And so they're going a little bit more significant difference. The last quarterly ratio was 1 to 22, not 1 to 16. And that's for every death, there was 22 wounded. That does not include the return to duty, though, that was in there. The specific question about, are we tracking it? There's a system called Blue Force Tracker that's a computer system that probably when General Caldwell and Ken Murphy are long gone and retired, some 22-year-old will be able to type into the records, and he'll be able to tell you where an Oregon National Guard vehicle was 20 years ago. Because the whole system is tracked. There's another system that tracks every one of these events with a 9-line report, and it's a system-wide, and literally you can call up. You can go back and say, Private Smith from this unit on this date, and you can search the system, and it will tell you every event that happened that day. And you can tell by unit, you can tell exactly what the vehicle rolled over in a mud bog, if it was an IED, everything, and there's nine lines of reportable information. The good news is the Army and the Navy use that very extensively when those units come back out. So not the Army, the Air Force and the Navy, and so they're able to tell right now for when a unit goes out that there were, these events happen, and they're doing that screening to a much better degree than the Army. The Army is talking about doing that, and it's probably saying it's doing it, but this is the greatest weapon in the United States Army, a pencil. So a lot of times they push that pencil and it doesn't happen. Unfortunately, the Marine Corps is even farther down the list in terms of not having the resources to track this. And the other thing that's kind of significant in the medical side is that the Marine Corps is more likely to have return to duties. And that's, even though you have the same medical staff, and as Senator Morissette was saying, I mean, you have a higher quality trained corpsman or medic on scene who can make the decision over the top of the commander, at least in the Army and the Marine Corps side, I don't know about the Air Force and the Navy, that says, you know, this guy's got to go. And so they're getting evacuated out, they're getting better treatment on the ground, much better, and it's much more timely going out. Having said that, if anybody knows what 4 foot of snow is and you think there's 853 significant events, the same report forecasts there'll probably be 900 deaths between now and June. So you can guess 900 times 22, and it'll give you kind of a picture of what it's going to look like in the next 6 months.
And you're able to supply this committee with the report?
Yeah, I have a copy of the report. Okay. It's all over the Internet. I don't know why. Political argument, I guess. Both sides arguing back and forth.
I think it would behoove this committee at least to get copies of that report, so we're aware of it as a group interested in these issues. So thank you. Thank you for that. Yes, Mr. Willis.
Yes, Madam Chair. The most significant thing to me as someone who advocates for veterans with regard to what Senator Boquist just said is the ability to go back and find out who was at an incident on a given place and what kind of an incident occurred. As late as the Vietnam War, one of the things that is challenging our veteran service officers in terms of filing a disability claim is being able to find what we call the battle buddy, who can confirm that this person was there when the attack occurred or the artillery shelling happened or the mortar shelling happened and so on, so that we then can get the appropriate disability for this person. It's very difficult to go back with an 8th Air Force raid over Germany in 1944 and determine if this person who was in a machine gun position on the aircraft was actually on that mission on that day. And we've had phenomenal success by just running people down, but now, given their ages and so on, it's harder to do with World War II, less difficult with Korea, but still hard, and still hard in Vietnam. So what Senator Boquist has described is something that is going to help veteran service officers deal with a veteran who comes in with a condition 20 years from now, and now has the ability to search databases, and we can actually represent them far better. So I think we're going to do better in the future. In fact, I know we are, than we are today.
Question.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you. That provoked something for me. I'm very pleased that we're doing things better now, and I kind of, my thought process likened it to as some of us have aged closer to being in need of senior services and have also grown politically active at the same time, I think that there will be some changes in the way we do things. Apparently, some of us have aged into political activity since they were young soldiers in Vietnam, and that may be making some changes for the future generations of post-deployment soldiers, and for that I'm appreciative. But it's the Vietnam era individuals who are of an age group that they, most of them are here with us and struggling with some of these issues. Now, I had a gentleman walk through the door of my in-district office when I just happened to be in there the other day. He apparently has been sort of laying in wait to see when I might be in the office, has been watching for me for some time, just wanted to talk, and he's in the middle of trying to get a disability claim processed. So it leads me to my question of, if Representative Esquivel is working through his disability claim and he says he was in country and exposed to this defoliant, do you have to find a battle buddy that confirms that that's the case
before,
rather
Madam
than
Chair,
him saying
Madam
he was
Chair,
there?
Members of the committee, I use that as an example. If he has a set of orders that he has kept from that time, or if he was assigned to a ship even though he was on shore at the time of his exposure, and he can give us the name or number of that ship, and we can go to ship's personnel and so on. There's a couple of different ways to verify that he was there. It just doesn't have to be one person. But the battle buddy works very well because that's a living human being that was also there.
But you do, in fact, have to have...
We have to have some
confirmation, that
yes.
The individual says they were in this place at this time. You have to find a confirmation.
That is correct. We do. And it has to accompany the, that's like evidence of the claim.
Okay.
And that has to accompany the claim to the VA so that the rater, the person who rates the claim, can verify that everything that the veteran is saying is verifiable.
I think it's helpful.
I don't want to make this sound difficult. It really, once you gather the information, it is not difficult.
Thank you. I appreciate that that's what our the job that our Veterans Service Officers do in helping people find ways to verify things. I think it's just helpful for us to understand the depth of the process that one must go through.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, Madam Chair, if I could take one more moment outside of the current subject and remind folks that we do ask that you turn your cell phones off during committee hearings. Thank you.
Thank you. I was just thinking the same thing. I will tell you all that I did have my cell phone on loud before I came in and put it to vibrate. So let's all be courteous to one another.
Well, they also impact the recording.
Yeah. So, colleagues, I'm going to ask right now a process question. Are there any additional comments or questions for Mr. Willis or Mr. Hines at this point in time? Okay. I want me to thank both of you for coming in today. This information, I think, is critical to how we move forward with our reintegration processes and how we work with our veterans. I'm going to call up now, again, with your permission as well, Madam Chair. We do have a veteran survey that was pulled together by the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And this is invited testimony from Gina Nickel, the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I'm going to ask Gina to step forward. The reason I asked to have this on the agenda is as someone who comes from a county background as well as Representative Cowan, you know our hearts are with the counties and that we will do anything we can within our power to work with county systems to help you with what your needs are, help you with efficiencies, and in particular because a lot of times the veterans are landing in various counties across the state, what we can do to help streamlining, to help those delivery service systems for these folks who are having mental health and addiction needs. And this survey, I was hoping you could frame for us so we could get a sense of where we can do better in collaboration with one another. So I wanted to just set that framework as you began your testimony. So
thank you.
Good morning.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good. Chair Schrader, Chair Cowan, committee members. My name is Dr. Gina Nickel. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and in my past experience, a county commissioner, but probably more important for this discussion, I was also a civilian ombudsman assigned to the Coast Guard, and I have a deep respect for the military and have worked with them quite often. We in 2005, we're really concerned with our troops coming home and being able to get services, particularly in the rural areas. So we worked with AMH, the Addictions and Mental Health Division, to put together some monies for transportation. We found out, particularly in the rural areas, troops coming home, their families were having difficulty getting access to care because of travel expenses. So we did put together some monies to do that. And we've been taking a look at what we can do as people come home. We've been working with reintegration summits. We also staged last Veterans Day, a Military Veterans Appreciation Day, and had a significant mental health component in that. That was helpful. We've been working with the VA and law enforcement on VA summits held at the Portland VA Medical Center. That's been very helpful. I and one of my staff members is also on the Women's Veterans Healthcare Task Force. To that end, we decided to do a survey because we didn't know how much our mental health directors were working at home with troops, and we wanted to know where the gaps and where the good things that we were doing so we could work on that. So the survey that you have, we found that 87.5% of the respondents, which is the community mental health programs, actually asked their customers if they were in the veterans, if they were a veteran or had served in the military. Would like to get that up to 100%, and that is our intent, and that's an area that we identified that we need to do. But we were pretty happy that it was 87.5 at this particular time. Only 39% of the respondents said that they were reimbursed by TRICARE. That is not, that's not a surprise. We would certainly like to be reimbursed better by TRICARE, but we weren't reimbursed when it was CHAMPUS, and that continues to be an issue because, of course, what the military would like us to do is make sure that people get services at the VA first. Of more of a concern in the survey was the number that 22% of the respondents on the community mental health programs didn't know what a CVSO does. Having worked closely in a number of counties with the CVSOs, I found that even the 22% a little bit alarming. So we actually have a campaign to work on that. And another 12% knew what their CVSO does but didn't refer anybody to them, so we are working to change that. We have a community health program director in Lane County who is a Vietnam vet, and he and I have talked about this, and we're working to make sure that the other community mental health programs are up to speed and using the resources that they have. Of particular concern and interest, and I think something that we really need to talk about, we have been at meetings with the VA and working with the VA, but lately we have found that really the issue is that there are no after-hours and weekend psychiatric admissions at the VA. At least that's what the survey said, the respondent said. If somebody has an issue and they're a veteran, we can't get them into the VA after hours. So normally we contacted the VA, and the current status is that VA policy allows after hours and weekend admission, but the actual process is dependent on a variable of issues, and at this particular point, we're not able to access that. So the Portland VA, they've seen these survey results, and they're working internally to draft a memo to community providers, and we want to clean up that process.
Yeah, I forget to ask, so particularly, what is this access issue? I mean, I'd like to dig a little deeper into that.
Well, typically, what happens is if a veteran displays psychiatric issues after hours, and usually it doesn't happen between 8 and 5 on a Monday through Friday. Usually law enforcement will get a call, and if that person has known that they're a veteran, we contact the VA, and it's hard to get them in at this particular point. But I believe because the relationships aren't there, the right things aren't in place, and we are working on that right now.
So it's protocol issues?
Yes, I believe so.
That's what I'm trying to understand. So it's just
well, certainly I'm looking at the survey and talking with the VA. There are many issues. The VA lacks acute care capacity. There are no community VA community service resources, and they rely on us to do that. So part of this is establishing relationships. It's like relationships with anybody. When you have a good relationship with them, you have that relationship. There's more that you can foster and do with each other. So we're working on that.
Let me just make sure I'm understanding that again, that when you say VA community service issues, I mean, we've got VA centers throughout this, you know, state.
Correct.
But what you're talking about is a particular VA presence in a local community that connects them to the larger centers, or the fact that we just don't have smaller community VA centers.
All of the above, Senator Schrader. So what happens that is the community mental health centers do have veterans groups, but there's no specific small community programs. Not everybody lives along the I-5 corridor and can access VA hospitals. You know, in a timely manner. So we just need to do a better job, and I feel that we are the community mental health programs and the VA to identifying where the lacking areas are and working together to hone those. It's one of resource. It's one of, you have to remember that Oregon typically has not been a military state. We do not have any bases like they do in Washington and California, and we are just getting up to speed. General Caldwell and myself have known each other for a long time, and that is something that is on our plate to do, is make sure that Oregonians understand the importance of their military and respect them. And I believe we are making good progress on that.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Not to interrupt you further, so with apologies, but before we leave this particular topic, I'd really like to, or this section of it, I'd like to highlight its importance. On your handout, the 5th or 6th bullet down that starts out, CMHP's report, good working relations with law enforcement, et cetera, and then you note that the ongoing burden on law enforcement and community mental health staff, who often have to wait several hours with the patient in the emergency department and provide transport. This, beyond that particular impact, this is a huge issue. Another one of the task forces that are out there that are groups that I've been working with is the emergency care group that's talking about the challenges to emergency rooms, and the term for it in that particular setting is boarding. I've visited my local emergency room, and I've been shown the psychiatric hold room that's available, and it is one of the rooms in the emergency department. It simply has some different features so that you sort of close off all the critical equipment and make it bare-walled. And if that room is occupied by an individual with a mental health crisis, it takes a room out of the system for the emergency department. And they tell me they've ended up with holds that have lasted greater than 24 hours. This is not appropriate to individuals. It's not an appropriate use of our emergency rooms. So it's very much system-wide, and that's why I appreciate some of what we're trying to do here, which is to bring in all of the pieces instead of say, well, if they did a better job, then this group would be okay. So I really appreciate the effort that you've gone to in putting some of this in numbers and data. It's a critical need that has to be addressed.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Cowan. And I think the important thing to remember is we all need to work together to address resource issues and how we're going to function in the communities, because the average citizen has access capacity, and we in no way have the capacity to treat vets when they do come home. And we stand ready to work with you on that, and this is an important issue at the community mental health program level. So anything we can do to help, please let us know.
Well, again, Jean, I know that you want to make a number of more comments, but if you don't mind, I was going to ask Mr. Himes if he has any comments he may like to make about this particular issue.
That would
at
be
this point, would that be fine? Would you mind?
Great. I'd love to have Jack join me.
Because, again, this is not... This is finding gaps so we can fix the gaps and collaborate. This is in no way attempting to, you know, put anyone on the spot. This is serious work so we can, as policymakers, help you do your jobs. So,
first of all, mental health is overburdened throughout the state, and that's the bottom line. You go to St. Vincent's Hospital. Right now, 20 people are on gurneys awaiting admission, would be a safe guess. Hospitals are on divert frequently for psychiatric issues. We've had additional beds that haven't touched the demand, and it's a very sad state of affairs. If a veteran has a psychiatric emergency, danger to himself or others, he or she goes to the local emergency room. It's not a vet issue. It's a psychiatric issue. The Portland VA is expanding its numbers of beds. We've had, in the 14 years I was at the VA, a psychiatric nurse practitioner in the emergency room for business hours, and in the last 2 years, we've had social workers there till 11. And after hours, there's a resident on call and an attending on call. Admissions can be made, but as noted, the VA is frequently full, and then we get into issues of gender and acuity. Frequently, veterans will be in the acute psych unit with lots of physical problems, typically a patient with Alzheimer's who's striking out and they can't handle them in a nursing floor will get transferred to the psych unit. So access is an issue because you're balancing a lot of different needs. But yes, you can admit 24/7, and it is that capability. But we're on divert also. Are there enough? And that's only Portland. Portland has the only, well, Seattle just changed, but we have the only locked unit in four states until Seattle just added theirs. In northeastern Oregon, they go to Walla Walla for their needs. Yeah. In southeastern Oregon, they go to Boise. We have a CBOC in Burns. They go to there's a social worker there. They get transferred to Boise for acute issues, and then we have White City and Roseburg. As the doctor said, we had multiple meetings with Bill Taylor, Mr. Harris from DHS, trying to work through this acute psych issue. We've had three or four meetings now with sheriffs, city police, jailers. So the conversations, and as you say, it's about relationship, have been occurring. It's not just veterans. It's a statewide issue, and Portland is incredibly overburdened.
I didn't pay him to say that.
Yeah. I'm retired. I can say you can't.
Yes. My, his tongue has been freed.
That's great.
Freedom.
Freedom.
He's right.
Senator Moses Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an issue that the hospitals and in our health committees we have been discussing. Hospitals don't like to keep psychiatric patients because there's no reimbursement many, many, many times, and it's a cost issue also. And so it's an ongoing issue, and we definitely are addressing it, but there has been no solution.
If I may, Madam Chair, the other issue is recruitment and training of staff. You can't get a psychiatrist in three-fourths of the state. Trying to find a social worker, an outpatient social worker, even in Bend, is difficult. Psychiatrists in Bend are difficult to find. So somebody who knows PTSD in Klamath Falls is tough to find. So there's, just because you're an LCSW or a psychologist doesn't mean you know how to treat PTSD. So there's a training issue, and there's just a plain recruitment issue. You know, you can't get a psychiatrist in Tillamook.
Yes.
And Chair, members of the committee, if I could add something to this. As many of you know, last August, Jack Heim and Paul Evans contacted me, and I talked to both chairs and the chairs of the Judiciary Committee, and we have had work group meetings which has brought the treatment end and the criminal justice end together. We're meeting next week on the 21st in this building at 1:30 in room 350. It's open to anyone. And mainly it's the people from both groups sitting down and talking. What I've found through this whole thing, it's not really legislation. There's a couple of legislative proposals coming through from this group. You'll hear of two of them today. But it's really just people making contact with each other and developing relationships. And most of the problems are being solved that way. Let me give it for an example. One of the issues that brought us, and Jack contacted me, was there were people in Portland before the courts who were on probation, they were post-prison supervision, whatever, who were veterans. There was a treatment program up in Washington, in-house treatment program. Well, we have what's called the Interstate Compact for Adult Offenders. It requires one state to contact the other. And if you're going to be gone for a period of 60 days, you have to transfer the paperwork up and everything like that, and that takes time. Well, the end result was Department of Corrections started talking to the Washington Department of Corrections directly, independent and at the same time through the compact. And they are in the process of streamlining that process so they can get people up there quicker and let them stay there longer. So that's what most of it's about.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes. Mr. Riley.
Thank you. That was one of the points that I wanted to make, is that the fact that we have a lack of resources for the psychiatric care is putting a huge burden on our local law enforcement,
right,
our court system, and our DOC. It's just, and in the process, putting a lot of veterans who shouldn't be in prison in prison. And that's a great concern to me, and I think that that's something that we really need to address. And I think we are, but we're not there.
And we stand ready to work with you in whatever the committee decides in what direction. We look forward to our continued working relationship with the VAs. I should tell you that ORPIC, Oregon Partners in Crisis, that is really concerned about, it's mainly law enforcement folks coming together with mental health folks to talk about how to reduce burdens in the law enforcement system. Just got a grant to work on the veterans issues, and we will be having several regional meetings to talk about this issue.
Madam Chair.
Later on this spring.
While we have our two guests here, I would like to take a moment to hear from Sherry Stock, who is the chair of the traumatic brain injury, and she has an issue that is related to this that hasn't been discussed, and it's relevant to what you're talking about. So could we call Sherry up?
I think we can do that. And then
Gina, again, in terms of time, I'm looking at process. Then we'll have you finish up, because the other piece of this I'm a little concerned about is the TRICARE issue as well. So why don't we have Sherry come up to talk about traumatic...
Can I leave here? But
then we will go back to this.
Representative Riley, we've been working with Mr. Taylor on a veterans court for that specific purpose. The Portland VA has designated a social worker to facilitate, who set up the veterans courts in the Clark County. So that's moving forward. And also there's a designated social worker on the probation while folks are in jail, while they're in prison, trying to catch them, and making that a seamless transition as well. So I'll leave.
Why don't you wait there?
No,
Sherry Stock has some questions that you may want to answer.
Okay, I was just bringing up with Mike, sir.
Okay. And then we can call Jack back.
There are three people
who
can sit
there, though. There we go. Okay.
We're getting,
I just want to, as a process point, we are kind of following a thread, so I will tell you, colleagues, we will loop back to the final piece of this and do a wrap-up, okay?
Hello.
Good morning.
My name is Sherry Stock. I'm the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, and I'm just going to add a few... actually compliment them on what they've been talking about. One is the 20% of the veterans or the troops that have sustained TBI, PTSD. The numbers, what that would mean is about 320,000 at a minimum. So we're talking some huge numbers across the country. Also, suicide has increased by over 26%, and it's in the newspaper frequently. This is, they come back and they have PTSD, TBI, they look normal, they act normal. They don't feel normal, they're not able to cope, and so they commit, suicide is just skyrocketing. Domestic abuse, child abuse, violence across the board, and it's, you know, that is impacting everything that we do. And a lot of this is bringing more awareness to brain injury. So I'm getting calls all the time to go and do trainings for corrections facilities now on how to work with people with brain injury. The parole officers have come to me about doing some training after they get out of prison, so because the recidivism rate is so high, it's almost 100%. If they have a brain injury, they come out on the street, they end up back in jail. And so how do you stop this? And so it's a lot of issues. There's no resources. There's no money. The mental health issue is a huge component. And the difference between traumatic brain injury and mental health is traumatic brain injury might have the same symptoms as some mental health issues, but it's trauma to the brain. It's neurological, so it is not, can't be corrected with chemicals. Massive amounts can help a little bit, but the truth is it's behavioral changes that takes a long time and a lot of money to change, and the resources aren't there. So once again, working together, and we're working together. I travel all over the U.S., and we are the only state in the United States that has a reintegration team working as hard and as closely as we are. No other state has anything this complex. So we're really ahead of the curve and way behind the curve in helping those coming back and needing the help.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate it. Now, Gina, can you... I hope we didn't distract you too much. But I think these were extremely important comments, and I'm very happy that you're here today. So let's move on, and we can...
Senator Schrader, the one issue that I wanted to just follow up and talk to you about is TRICARE. The reason that I believe that TRICARE only pays about 39% of their claim. Part of that is standard business procedure by the insurance companies. But I also believe that TRICARE's their first line is that
Veterans should be treated, and people that have been attached to the military should be treated at the VA. And so quite often they first turn down insurance payment because that person is treated in the community rather than the VA. So that's just an issue that I think we'll have to work with our federal delegation mm-hmm. with to put pressure on the military to make sure that these claims are paid. Because not everybody has complete access or timely access to the VA. We can certainly get them there and facilitate transport, but there's some times where issues need treated now, not tomorrow or the next day.
Mm-hmm. To me, colleagues, just a comment, that was a very striking thing to read in this report, and I suspect we're going to be working, if not at least during the February session. There are other issues with TRICARE that I won't belabor for the sake of time. I see General Caldwell nodding his head and Mr. Warnock that need to be addressed, and I think this is a huge piece of it, because as I perused the survey, that to me was a really, really absolutely jumped out at me in a way where I felt there needs to be, if it isn't a legislative fix, and some kind of fix with through whatever pressures or authorities we need to bring to bear on this issue.
And the last thing that I would leave you with, actually Senator Monis Anderson and I and others have worked tirelessly on this issue. Obviously, we don't have the resources to undergird the capacity, the psychiatric and acute care capacity right now, or the community capacity. But I still think that we need to continue to have these discussions because there's not enough capacity in the community level, at the acute care level, and at the state hospital level. We need to continue to have these discussions how we're going to fund a program for anybody in Oregon.
And I, for one, would like to do some follow-ups with you on these particular issues, not only from my office, but perhaps for both of our committees, so we can start solving these problems, these issues, these challenges.
I'd be honored to. Thank you.
Colleagues, are there any additional questions or comments at this time? All right, Mr. Taylor, again, for the sake of time, because I know that this is a joint meeting with our House colleagues, so we want to move on to their agenda. On the Senate agenda, we have two legislative concepts, Legislative Concept 35, which will direct the Department of Transportation upon request to ID veterans on driver licenses and identification cards, and then we have another legislative concept which would allow our district attorneys greater discretion in diverting veterans charged with a crime for treatment programs. And so I am going to ask you the process here. These are two committee bills I would like to see moved out today. They're LC drafts, and so what is the process for that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the process for the Senate is different than for the House.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Your bills, Senate bills, are up for work session, which means there's no public testimony, but you could have invited testimony, and we do have people who are involved in putting these bills together if you'd like to hear from them. For the House, the bill is for a public hearing only, which means if the public would like to testify in the bill, they will get to testify, but there'll be no vote on it because there's no work session. That's basically the process and procedure.
I guess we should start with Legislative Concept 35.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Yeah. I can briefly explain Legislative Concept 35, and I believe Tom Mann and Paul Evans. Paul was here a second.
Excuse me. I have some very more experienced colleagues for me, which have explained I need to officially open this as a work session.
That's true.
Okay, thank you, colleagues, for that. Okay. So I've done that. All right. We've done that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we're in work session.
All right. Yes, we are.
Madam Chair, I'd move that Legislative Concept 35 and 54 be introduced as committee bills in the February session.
Okay. Okay, do you have a second on that? Or again, do we have any invited testimony? Anyone would like to second?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did talk to them, and I would just as soon have you move the bills.
I'm actually thinking quicker's better. Yeah, I'm fine with that.
So I'm assuming I have a second on that.
We don't second, we just ask all in favor.
So all are in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
That was easy.
Woohoo, we did that. Thank you. You have to excuse me. Sometimes I'm still into
County Commissioner.
Commissioner mode, right? We have to ask for a second and a vote. So I promise I'll do a little better. Maybe I should watch a few more videos.
We're just efficient, Madam Chair. We're ready to move.
You know, these county people, let me tell you. All right, so with that, we have moved forward then with these two bills as committee bills, and I will turn this over to my colleagues.
We already have two bills.
You have some few things on your agenda.
I turned my back on you for a moment, and you're just moving right along, aren't
you? Yeah. Just to help with my friends. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're moving now into a bit more informal, no formal action anticipated portion of the hearing for the House side of it, if you will, and I hope our good colleagues will stay with us. We will hopefully have some additional interesting information. So I am going to open a. I'm looking to see if I don't believe Representative Roblin is with us yet, and I know that he wanted to be part of the conversation on LC 205.
Roblin.
So I think that we may postpone that in just a bit. That's a discussion of the Interstate Compact on Educational Opportunity for Military Children. And we'll move instead to conversation around a possible bill dealing with reintegration issues. Committee, you will recall that we sort of held open a committee bill to see if anything would come forward from the Reintegration Task Force that would be timely, that should have action taken on it in the February session. And my understanding is that that conversation has sort of taken two separate tracks. I still have a podium in front of me, so I can't see the whole back row. Is Mr. Evans with us?
Yes.
Okay. There is. Yeah, he's right behind the flip chart here, and I'm sorry, I couldn't see you. So we're going to talk a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, about some of the conversations around transitional housing needs and the recovery parks. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Oh, there is a back row.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I actually felt a little safer with the camouflage up. I was reminded of, not from you, ma'am, but from the camera, just old habits die hard. I like hiding.
You were well hidden, yes.
Yes, ma'am. That's good. Chair Cowan, Co-Chair Schrader, members of the committee, there's been a number of different discussions about possibilities for veterans initiatives this session, and what I'd like to do, if I could, is take the next 3 or 4 minutes to read the remarks that are being distributed to you. Hopefully this will take a few complex issues, put them in a simple form, and then I'll try to respond to any questions. So again, thank you for the opportunity to be here. For the record, my name is Paul Evans. I'm a Senior Policy Advisor for Military and Veterans Affairs for Governor Kulongoski, and I'm very honored to be able to participate in this proceeding this morning. That is something I don't take for granted, by the way. I really do appreciate the opportunity to share with you on the progress and status of proposals and policy that impact family, military families and veterans. Today, before I comment on the specific areas that Chair Cowan has asked me to focus upon, I want to publicly commend the following people for doing so much for so long for so many. Director Willis and Deputy Director Paula Brown, who had to depart, and Tom Mann, who currently is still in the room, I believe, have proven themselves the ideal public servants over the past 3 years, and I've been blessed to work with them. The outreach effort that they have accomplished, you'll hear more about later, but just in simple terms, 1,300 Oregonians have the opportunity to know more about their veterans' benefits is a direct result of your House Bill 3104 that was passed and their efforts to execute it. I have some materials here that I can share, but I think the most visible one really is the income tax cover for the in-tax forms that are going to be handed out, both of which have a very large emphasis for veterans' information that hopefully will stimulate discussion, dialogue, and people pursuing that, which never would have happened had the outreach program that you championed not passed. So those things are actually becoming reality. Most recently, as I've had to focus upon other matters, mostly emergency preparedness, Mr. Tom Mann has been the glue hole in the statutory task forces together. He was actually doing that before, but now we can just kind of point to it and say that he's the guy. He really is the master that keeps the people on task through both conviction and love. Whatever progress has been made, whatever accomplishments now measurable are reality because of the group moving the words into real life. It's also critical to acknowledge a traveling band of brothers, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Colonel Mike Burton retired, Captain Jim Booker, Air Force retired, First Lieutenant Robert Plame, Marine Corps retired, Jack Himes, now officially retired, which I understand he's explained to you several times, and Colonel Scott McCray, who's also retired. This, with respect to the FAME television program, this special bunch of folks, and they've actually been compared to that, has continued the work of the task force, traveled across the state, seeking neither recognition nor fame, but they quietly travel and try to bring people together and work on projects both big and small. They are, in fact, the force multiplier. They epitomize the term citizen servant, and I think that sometimes they need to be recognized, and this is one of those moments. Since the last Joint Veterans Committee meeting, there's been a lot of work accomplished, and again, I'll let the specifics of those task forces be explained by Co-Chair Schrader on reintegration and others as the opportunities arise. But in general, as a participant and observer of the task force on these groups, I can report to you that your interests are being well served. As we've discussed in the past, too often task forces are formed without sufficient focus or resources to accomplish the assigned mission. In the end, I believe the legislature and the people of Oregon will be well served by these proposals that are reported out. I'm actually very excited about a number of them coming forward, especially from transportation. So, that's clearing the deck. Here are some issues that I was asked to follow up on, and I'll try to work through the list. After considering the available resources, including time, which is in fact one of our most important resources going into the February session, the group working on these issues determined that we could not forward a bill for an act regarding transitional housing for veterans, at least as a part of the evolving recovery park concept. As you recall from our last discussion, there was a recognition that there are spaces that have the potential for multiple use, there are spaces that have infrastructure and support, and that the state parks are routinely used during disasters, and if there was a way to invest in those resources in a way that could provide a space for transitional veterans housing, that should be pursued. We did pursue it. The obstacles currently in place are a little bit larger than we have the time to navigate, so we're splitting those apart. We're going to continue working on the recovery park concept for emergency preparedness, which will be discussed at a later date. But we're also following up on transitional housing. And what I mean by that is there's really two components to homelessness or housing challenges for veterans. If we look at the reintegration, the first 36 months, as folks come back trying to get back into their life, often where you live or how you live and where you're going to work are related. We're recognizing that there are some challenges there, and as we continue deployments at the rate that we're deploying, those are going to be larger challenges over time for the National Guard and Reserve, and in fact, for the regular troops that are coming off active duty. We also recognize that the traditional idea of homelessness among veterans, which has been a growing problem, is something that has become a priority for the Department of Veterans Affairs, and Secretary Shinseki has determined a 5-year plan to end homelessness among veterans. So, from a policy perspective, we're actually kind of drawing a little bit of a distinction between the transitional first 36 months back assistance to get folks back up on otherwise a normal transition and the kinds of care that is necessary to put together for folks that have been homeless for some time, including access to health care, including access to treatment and other types of things. So both of those are part of the vocabulary, but the transitional housing is really what we were looking at for the recovery parks, and it is the transitional housing that I'll continue talking about. There are some interesting opportunities that have arisen from conversations as I've traveled the state in the last several weeks talking with different levels of government and different kinds of folks. One of the conversations we hope to follow up on that does not require legislation, but I want to make sure you're aware of it so you know that we're continuing the work, is discussions with counties that have fairgrounds, that may have space for short-term or temporary transitional housing. In the fire service, at least the remote and rural areas of the fire service, it is not uncommon to have what's called resident volunteers. When I was a younger volunteer, we used to call them sleepers. I don't think that's the term that people use anymore, but nonetheless, the deal was for room and board, or at least room, you'd go to school, you could have a place to stay, and you'd cover certain hours to make sure that there were enough folks on engines and things like that. In some counties, at least in a couple that I had conversations with about this concept, there was interest in actually having folks on the fairgrounds working on projects around the fairgrounds and at the same time receiving a short-term benefit to be able to live in a place that's clean, safe, available, and help people get back up on their feet. This, again, is not requiring legislation at this point. Just want to let you know that that is an interesting conversation that is evolving, and we hope to be able to report back to you in February with where those conversations have led. Second, I was asked to provide information on emerging proposals for legislative consideration in February 2010, as well as for the 2011 general session. There are a couple of concepts at various levels of development, and again, these are focused on 2011. We want to make sure and measure twice, cut once, but I think it's incumbent to ensure that you know where we're at and what we're thinking, and quite frankly, to help improve the product. We need your advice, we need your counsel, and we believe that we're on the right track on some of these. One concept that is relatively new that I'd like to briefly talk about in conceptual form, and anybody that's interested in continuing this conversation afterwards, I welcome the discussion. But it's a concept to utilize the unique specifics of Title X duties and the impact upon National Guard reservists as well as folks coming off of active duty, Title X, for reintegration. The concept in a nutshell is looking at the model of the unemployment insurance, where people pay into it, hoping that they would never have to draw from it, but when they do, it's available for them. And it's basically currently everybody pays in, everybody has the opportunity when needed to take that assistance. If we put that in housing and we frame it around those that are on Title X orders, meaning those that are being paid by Title X dollars, through a small set-aside, I would suggest, at least for discussion at this point, we're based on rank, based on the normal requirements that the military has for housing allotments that they already have. I would suggest using a simple system that's already there. But through a small allotment, the time on active duty could provide funds so that when a person comes off active duty, on a ratio of 1 month on to 3 months of benefit, we could get up to the 36-month reintegration period for a one-year tour. So if that makes sense, somebody's comes off of active duty. They come back into civilian life. They're trying to find a job. They're having a tough time finding a place to live. They would be able to automatically, because they've paid in, they're part of the process, they'd be able to draw a benefit for housing for a formula-based period of time based on their service. So this voucher or entitlement or whatever you think of it could be a tool in helping that veteran get back up on their feet, just another tool in the toolkit. Again, most people do not need that. It would have to be a minimal fee out of the paycheck when you're on Title X, and we'd want to make sure that the dollars are very well prescribed. Clearly, this is a federal issue, not a state issue, but this is a concept that if it is to your favor, could be turned into a resolution and tied to work with the congressional delegation like you have already done on the 8 previous resolutions, and certainly could stimulate a discussion about the need for transitional housing for veterans and reintegration. The reason I emphasize the pay scheme, it's not ideal. It'd be great if the funds could just be set aside as part of the military budget, but under the current congressional pay-go requirements that I suspect will be even more important after the health care debate is finished and the dollars are finally added up, it's best to go into with a plan that can potentially over time pay for itself. So that is a concept for a resolution only that I suspect would be better for 2011, but if it was the will of the committee, we could put it together by 2010. But it is a resolution, much to be discussed and debated, much to be worked out. But so far, the initial discussions have been positive about this approach. Are there questions on that? I see Representative Freeman.
Thank you, and I think it's a very fascinating idea. I just think it would be awful hard to come up with an actuary to kind of figure out how much you're going to take. I mean, I understand it's a nationwide type view of it, but still, it seems like it would be pretty hard to figure out on the front end so you can assure to be able to pay for it on the back end. But I kind of like the idea of it. And yeah. What groups have you talked to about it?
Chair Cowan, Representative Freeman, we have had a series of follow-up town hall meetings throughout the state to basically go back and talk about what the legislature passed so people had better understanding. In bits and pieces, it's been discussed in Medford. In bits and pieces, it's been discussed in Columbia County, Lane County. In bits and pieces through email and phone conversations. Only in the last several days have we actually used the unemployment model as a funding piece. Everybody recognizes that there's a need for transitional assistance. And this really was stimulated, quite frankly, by the discussion before your committee last month or month before when we were trying to figure out how do we use available resources to try to find a fix for that 36-month gap. And again, not for 100% of the people. Most people will have a place to live, especially Guard Reserve. They have families. They're coming back. But for those that don't, trying to utilize really the market forces of the folks serving on Title 10 to make sure that the adjustment from Title 10 is easier. So we're at, a very beginning stage of the details. It's more of the concept of recognizing that there needs to be some focus on that transitional housing piece to ensure we don't end up with a larger homelessness issue downrange. So, 2011 would be great. If somebody wanted to do it in 2010, I think it is possible, but I'm not here today suggesting any legislation for 2010.
Thank you. And because it appears there may be a little discussion, would you mind if we took a break before we get to your second concept and recognize
yes,
Representative Roblin since he is here at this point?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. That we're going to back up to our discussion of LC 205. Is this a public hearing? It is a public hearing, so I will open a public hearing on legislative concept 205 and recognize Representative Arnie Roblin.
Thank you, and for the record, my name is Arnie Roblin, representative from House District 9 in Coos Bay to Florence. Last session, this bill came before this committee, and there was a number of concerns that were addressed by the Department of Education, and it has to do with an educational compact. And I had a chance to look over their concerns. Washington actually had the same concerns and went ahead and passed the compact. I'm not sure what they did differently. I better check that out. I just found out that they did pass it. I think 11 other states have already gone on board on this one. It's gone fairly quickly for a compact of any kind. And I understand, and I've worked with Morgan Allen and agree that a number of his issues need to be addressed, and I think there are ways to do that. Example, the way it's written, their explanation of what a local education unit is different, because every state is different about their education things. And so I think there needs to be another portion of this, and I hope to work with them and with Representative Matthews to see if we can find a way in which we can add on some concepts for definitions with respect to the compact so that it meets the needs of Oregon. But my concern is this. Having been a high school principal, we probably ended up with one or two students who were military family children who ended up at Marshfield High School in Coos Bay. And they ended up through no fault of their own, Oftentimes, they were with single parents, or they were with both parents who were in the military, who all of a sudden were off to active duty. And so they looked around and said, who's the closest relative, whether it was grandmother or aunt and uncle or whatever, and that person ended up to be in Coos Bay. And so they would send this child with the records that they had from the school that he was in to the high school. And we had made a commitment at our school, and I do agree that the State Department has given a lot of latitude. I would tell counselors, you check with the previous school and find out if they were on track to graduate. And if they were, we will find a way that they're on track to graduate here. There shall be no, and we will find that avenue for them. What I found in conversations with other people, that they ended up coming to our school because they tried a couple other places with relatives, and the schools had not done that. And so, even though it's available, doesn't mean that they do it. And so, I will continue to work with the department and see if there's other ways that we can do it by rule. But I think joining the compact sends a message to veterans' families that in Oregon, as in a number of these other states, we are going to figure out a process, and maybe we'll expedite it a little differently. We'll talk about how to make the committees that are out there. We'll talk with our veterans department to get that to happen. But I would hope that as we work through this session, we can come up with those little fixes that add to this to make it so that the Department of Ed and others don't believe it's going to cost a lot of money. I don't think it needs to. I would contend in Oregon, we do have Coast Guard families that move, but I will tell you that Coast Guard people tend to move more systematically, in the sense that they know when it's happening and they end up coming here, and they try, the families will sometimes stay behind until the new semester starts. The problem happens when a person leaves in one place and they haven't finished the semester, and they come to ours at the beginning of the new semester, and the other school says, well, we're not going to give credits because they didn't finish the last week. And we say, we have to start from here. And all of a sudden, the student loses a whole semester of work. And they look ahead and they say, well, I'm not going to graduate. I might as well just go get a GED or do something else. And their last experience with schools is not a positive one. I don't think it should happen that way. And I do appreciate that Oregon has really developed a system that allows individual school districts to make a lot of really good choices in helping with that. But that doesn't mean that all school districts do that. And that's why this bill was important to me. And it affects, we're going to have a new NOAA base here. They would fall under this one. So would Coast Guard people. So would any military people who are in the military whose families end up being disrupted and sent back. And that's the thing that I find. We don't have a lot of military bases, so unlike Washington, where I think there would be a lot of these issues, because of McCord and some of the other bases they have, for us, it's less, but it's for that one kid, it's 100%. And for me, as a high school principal, I was about that 100%, that kid, being able to say, you know, I successfully completed it. We did a couple things at our school where we actually had the school send to our school the final exam so they could take them at our school. We'd send them back there. When it came to the point where they would say they could graduate and we didn't think we could get all our requirements in, we would say, well, if we do these things and we send you a transcript of our school, can he graduate from your school? And a number of schools would do that, and that's really where the student wanted to graduate from. Sometimes it was their last semester and they ended up being here, and if we could help them graduate from the school they came from, it was a great experience at the end of the year. And kids need to believe that people truly care about their individual needs, especially when their family's being disrupted, their parents are off to defend our country, and they're being shuffled around because that's the only option they have. I think we have an opportunity in this way to work this compact out and make it work for Oregon. So that's my hope. I'm not sure that it's exactly ready yet. I continue to talk to Morgan. I will continue to work with anybody who wants to try to get something out in 2010. And any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Representative. This is an issue that came before this committee, and I believe that there were pieces of the overall picture that were not explored at that time in terms of impact on Oregon and Oregon children. So I appreciate you bringing it back for more discussion. I think there were some questions. I know Representative Freeman had one, and we'll work our way through here.
Thank you, Chair Cowan. Representative Roblin, I really appreciate you bringing this back up. It happens to be an issue that is affecting a really good friend of mine who has since retired from the military but won't move back to Oregon until his kids graduate high school. And I think it's a little bit sad that we have to have a 27-page bill to fix what should be a simple fix, but
I
do understand how complex some of these issues are, but I think there's a whole other segment of people that would like to come back to Oregon, if not for this situation where their children can't. So I appreciate you working on it. Anything I can do to assist you in that, I would love to be a part of. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I will say that the department has worked really hard to try to figure out if there's things that they can do by rule as opposed to this. And I'm willing to look at that. I just think that the thing that's nice about the compact, once it's done across the country, then every military family will know that's part of what they can expect their kids to be treated. And even though states are different, they know that they're going to have an opportunity for their kid. And that's the part that intrigues me about the compact and why I think it's a nice way of doing it, if we can figure out how to make it mesh with what we have in Oregon.
Representative Riley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing I have is, you said that your high school, you know, did this routinely and other school districts don't. And what I want to know is, when this bill is passed, what causes those other school districts to start doing it?
I think that if it's the compact, there's a group that will intercede with that for that child at the school district that comes from the committee that's formed in this deal that represents these families and these kids. And that was one of the expenses that this bill looked like it might have. And I'm trying to figure out if there's a way that an existing committee that's already there for the military could take on that duty, so we won't have to reinvent the wheel and have another one. But it actually gives them an avenue to talk to the Veterans Department or the our military department, and then those people intercede with the school district to explain and show them maybe how they could have done it.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
And the other issue in here is, I noticed that there is a governing board for this, and they have the ability to set budgets. How does that fit with our...
And that was one of the issues that came about with regard to part of the conversation that came about the last one that came from the Department of Ed, and you can ask them at the future as this bill moves on, has to do with giving up some of our responsibility as... and anytime you go into a compact with other states, that is part of the issue.
Correct.
You're going to give up something to gain something else. This one is this a big enough issue for the few kids that it affects, that we're willing to give up some of those responsibilities to a group that would deal with it. Again, I look at I can't imagine that that's going to cost a lot of money for schools to do this, but it is one of those parts of this bill, of any compact, and we've signed a few in the past, that you actually give up some of the states' rights issues with respect to very, very finite, well-defined issues, and this is one of those which I think personally supersedes the state when we're talking about protection of our country and these kids.
Thank you.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for bringing this forward, Representative Rublin. It's unfortunate that you have to. That's what's sad here. I'm not sure whether it's a territorial thing, whether it's a power situation, or what this amounts to, but I can't imagine we're putting our children in a secondary position to our policy, where we can't work together and work with other institutions to ensure that that child graduates. I mean, it's beyond my comprehension. But if there's anything I can do to help you, and I have not read this yet thoroughly through, but so far what I've read is fine. If there's anything I can do to help, I will do so.
I appreciate that, and I agree wholeheartedly with you. And if this weren't an issue that was probably happening all over the country, it would never have gotten to the point that CSD and these others worked to make it a compact. And so obviously this is something that's been happening around the country in lots of different states. And I will tell you that I contend that our Department of Ed has worked hard at making this a non-issue in Oregon, and they continue to want to make that happen. So I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that sometimes it's nice to go together with everybody else so that when you learn in one thing, you know you have somebody to help you when you get someplace else. And when you stick out and you're not one of those people who join on, then it gives a message to people, even if you're doing everything you can to make them feel comfortable when they get here, that somehow you don't agree with it or something. I think messages sometimes are as important as the policies when it comes to certain ways we treat people. And this one, for me, is about treating these kids appropriately.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? This then will follow through the process of being filed, and we'll have an opportunity for hearings on it. I do think that there was some misunderstanding in the initial stages in terms of the fact that most Oregon children don't transfer from base to base like any state that has a military base, and how much applicability there might be. I think it's appropriate that you point out that we do house a number of Coast Guard stations, and certainly individuals transfer within the Coast Guard, and I appreciate your recognition of the fact that the NOAA organization falls into this kind of regulation as well, because we do plan to bring some NOAA folks to Oregon in May of 2011, and that would be sort of just before the end of the school year. So I think that's an appropriate piece of this. The last thing that Oregon and my community has any desire to do is to make that move difficult for any of the NOAA employees. We are welcoming them in every way that we can, and certainly I wouldn't want it to be an educational challenge for their youngsters. So thank you for bringing this forward. Is there anyone else who would like to speak to this issue this morning? Yes, indeed.
And thank you.
Oh,
and
thank
Morgan.
You. Good. I didn't Morgan. Come in, Morgan. I'm sorry.
Morgan continues to work well, and we keep working with this one. Okay. So we'll see where we go from this. Thanks, Morgan.
And I have another meeting, so I'm going to slip off.
Thank you for coming. I appreciate you taking the time.
How many kids?
Okay. I've heard things like 20, but I just don't. Maybe Morgan, you can answer that.
Thank you, Chair Cowan. For the record, my name is Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. I appreciate Representative Roblin's kind words, and I'm sorry I got here a little late. I was trying to pull off the act of being in two committee hearings at one time, or actually a task force and a hearing at one time. I just wanted to share with the committee, and I know that I came during the session and shared these same issues, but I just wanted to share some of the issues that Representative Roblin raised, so the committee has that information as we're trying to work through a fix to this. Just a couple of things to highlight, and I think Representative Roblin highlighted these well. The bill does definitely need some more specificity for their several staff positions and councils, and the current compact does not designate whether that's the responsibility of the military department or the Department of Ed or some other state entity. Just a couple other interesting comments, and Representative Riley was talking about this a little bit. Cindy Hunt, who's the department's legal affairs coordinator and spent over a decade at Legislative Council as the Education Policy Council, believes that there are separation of powers and delegation of powers issues with the current bill as drafted. So those are a couple of examples of things we'd need to work through if we wanted to sign on to the compact. And just a couple interesting other notes. Representative Freeman, you described a retired or non-active duty person who is unwilling to come back to Oregon because of this concern about transferring grads and things like that. Well, the compact wouldn't cover that family. It only covers active duty military personnel. So people not in active duty, retired, you know, children of retired veterans or things like that are not covered by the compact. And that's one of the things we've been working with Representative Roblin on, because we feel like Oregon law actually goes further than the compact in protecting the rights of our kids to get those transfer credits. So that's something that the committee may want to address as well. You can read through the rest of it. You know, I don't want to belabor the point, and I realize you're short on time, but thank you for the opportunity. I just wanted to make sure you guys had all that information as you're deliberating what to do as we move forward. And again, I appreciate Representative Roblin working with us on trying to figure out how to make this legally workable for the Oregon statute. So thanks for your time, Representative Cowan.
Thank you. And our administrator has a question.
Chair, members of the committee, you may want to tell Cindy Hunt that we've worked on two of these compacts before, and the issue has come up as it relates to improper delegation, constitutional issues. So she may want to look at the adult compact for adult offenders.
Yeah. Okay.
And the juvenile compact. And there was an opinion issued on the adult compact by the Attorney General's office for the Department of Corrections and how to draft the compact so it would not violate the Oregon Constitution. And the council and state government, the people who administer the compact, were fine with the changes, because one of the challenges you face in a compact is the language among and between the states has to be significantly close to each other. It's in the nature of a contract. If you have the language differs too much, you don't have a contract.
Well, we thank you for coming today and making sure that we're aware of the spectrum of the conversation. I know that we did touch on this in the past, and if you can both come back to us and tell us that we've worked all of this out by rule and that we don't need legislation that and our children are protected, that would be swell.
That's what we're shooting for, Representative. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your time this morning. With that, we will close the public hearing and reopen the informational discussion that we were having. Thank you for your patience.
Chair Callen, members of the committee, I'm, for the record, I'm still Paul Evans, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Fungoski from Military Veterans Affairs. Just want to make sure I follow the rules there. The next issue is far more...
Madam Chair, can Seth comment on these or not? Or is it just...
Of course, I just didn't look far enough to my right.
On your previous, previous transitional housing... is the intent to have this exclusively just for veterans, or are you looking at working with other agencies in the communities that are having or have transitional housing? And I'm thinking of, say, in Rockwood, we have Human Solutions is building a transitional housing unit in that area, and I'm just wondering if there are coalitions that could be made with other agencies so that a certain number of beds could be for those people in that particular community, or are you just sort of looking for a place for just vets?
Chair Cowan, Senator Moss Anderson, the first proposal that I've just talked about was really just for vets because it would be, again, federal government levying what amounts to a tax on those that are receiving Title X pay to help former Title X people have housing assistance. So that is basically following the individual. The second proposal that I was about to introduce goes to the heart of what you're talking about in terms of utilizing existing partnerships and relationships, potentially bringing in outside funds that are for veterans in general, but for can be levied and can be arranged and partnered and shared with other housing and homelessness programs to get more bang for our buck when we try to construct, or more bang for our buck when we try to access treatment programs or things like that. So the first proposal really is just for folks because of the pay scheme and because of the inherent logic of those that are on active duty, recognizing that when they come off active duty at whatever time they're going to need a little bit of assistance, and arguably the ability of them to help generate their own fund for that purpose. The second is really plays much more into Secretary Shinseki's 5-year plan for ending homelessness among veterans. And you can't do that, I think, in a vacuum, and I don't think you want to do that in a vacuum. Currently, we are exploring a couple of pilot programs across the state, one of which I can mention today. We're actually trying to, as you know better than me, there are different pots of money for different kinds of programs, especially at the federal level. One pot that's not terribly been either explained well or accessed well is the faith-based initiative money. And in February, we're actually bringing out the director of the faith-based initiatives from the VA to meet with folks in Washington County to come here and be available if there's time on the calendar for veterans committees to look at exactly what you're talking about. Shared investment dollars that could be done to assist veterans but also other populations that are in the process of trying to utilize the ability of faith-based organizations that have a specific mission in their communities. We feel that the timing is right with Secretary Shinseki's focus on that issue. We also recognize that every win when it comes to homelessness for veterans is actually a win for everybody because it frees up state resources. Because if you get a veteran health care, in treatment, those are federally paid as opposed to state, so it potentially opens up capacity. So we're looking at those options. And really what I was coming to share with you this morning and ask really for your support on is as we pursue these conversations, they're going to probably cross different lines and different traditional policy spheres. And I'd like to have the involvement of a member or two of the committee as we navigate those, because I think that it is a rich area for shared resources discovery, and I think as we all look at both the federal government that's going to stop being able to print extra money and the state government that's constrained, there are some inherent ways we can do some things better that will require some tough discussion, and I think we're at that stage. And I think for veterans coming home, housing is an important issue on the transitional side, because I think that it is all too easy after three or four tours to just check out of everything and before long find yourself in a problem that is much larger, much more expensive, and really robs the state of talent and capacity. So that's a rambling answer, but I think that we can have those discussions. Yeah.
We have another unit in our district called My Father's House, and that is faith-based. Mm-hmm. And, again, beautiful facility, really built not with any public funds.
Right.
But there are others that are using some public funds and grants, too. So I would hate to limit the possibilities to just faith-based, but there are other transitional housing units that are going up that could very well help this issue.
Chair Cowan, Senator Moss Anderson, and what I'm actually here today to ask for is permission for ODVA to play a larger role in those discussions. Mm-hmm. We started that with the task force. I mean, I want to emphasize that Housing Community Services, where Victor Merced was actually at the first meeting, Peggy followed on. We haven't had conversations without, or I should say we haven't had conversations in a vacuum, but I think it's time that we emphasize that transitional housing piece as an additional element to traditional concepts about homelessness for veterans. And I wanted to report to the committee that we'd like to go forward and we'd like your help on actually having a person at the table as we go through that discovery.
Thank you.
So
were you finished with this presentation? I didn't want to interrupt.
Yes, Chair Cowan, one last thing.
Okay.
I just
yes,
wanted
please.
To brag on your committee administrator for his work on bringing, exactly as he said earlier, the elements of the court system and the elements of treatment together. I think that there's going to be a number of proposals in the 2011 session that come forward as a direct result of his effort. And just, you probably don't know how much time he spends on this, which he may actually have by design, I'm not sure, but the fact of the matter is he's making a tremendous difference. And at the end of the day, today, 2010, because of your efforts, veterans in Oregon are better served than any veteran in the country. Now, the challenge, of course, is that we're ramping up our efforts in Afghanistan, and we're going to be continuing to make veterans by the thousands for some time to come. But just as one of the 351,000 of us in Oregon, thank you for what you do, and the governor truly appreciates all your efforts to help his proposals and help these proposals move forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Ms. Evans, thank you for the compliment, but I must add, this is an area that it's enjoyable to work in. I do a lot of work in the criminal justice area, and at times people don't get along as well. In this area, everyone's trying to do the right thing, and everyone is working towards a common goal. So that's what makes it a lot more easier and a lot more enjoyable.
Thank you for the presentation. I would like to highlight just one piece in the second concept around broader discussion of housing options. One of the notes you made, that this is not a call for reallocation of existing capacities. And I think that's important, and in the comments that the good senator made, we have to be careful because we have such limited capacity that we're not moving one population out in order to serve a second one. But if we can tag on to expansion opportunities with some additional specifically allocated units with the assistance, hopefully, of other funds, that's the goal that we all have. You know, you made the comment about crossing different lines and different policy spheres, I think was the way you put it. From my perspective as chair of this committee, and I haven't heard disagreement from my committee at this point, that's exactly what we need to do. We can't keep operating in a vacuum of any given issue, and bringing our collective efforts together hopefully will be positive for our entire population. So
if you're looking for permission to continue this conversation, my suspicion is the committee not only allows permission but enthusiastic support for the kinds of efforts you're doing. We appreciate that.
Thank you,
all
Chair
of
Cowan.
The folks who are working on this.
Madam Chair, I think the Senate members would concur with your last statement.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today. And the second piece of that sort of, not for you, but I believe for our next presenters, the general concept when we started talking about this whole transitional housing, how could it relate to some other work that we were doing in the world of emergency prep and recovery parks concept, those discussions have sort of split into two discussions at this point, and I'd like to offer Ken Murphy and General Caldwell, if he's joining you, an opportunity to just sort of bring the committee up to date on where that piece of the discussion is at this point. I think that my understanding, at least going in, was the idea of finding physical locations where we could have the infrastructure in place to be prepared to do a quick setup of an emergency operation wherever we might be. And I wanted to tie some temporary housing into that during the times we didn't need it. My visions don't always come true exactly as I see them, but we are working on the emergency response piece. Is that correct?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Ken Murphy, the Director of Office of Emergency Management, is here today to discuss some of those things. I think if I might just dial back just a couple of degrees on your previous statement, or comments, and I certainly agree with Paul Evans and what he's presented to you. However, I think there's one aspect that your comments at the end, Madam Chair, made me think of this with respect to working across the different silos in state government. But I think the most important thing that we can do for veterans, particularly when it comes to housing and other issues that plague them on their return, is find them a job. And I think that we have done a few minor tweaks the legislature has over the last several years to try and aid in that process, and I certainly, with no disrespect toward what the Department of Employment has done, because they have done a fabulous, fabulous job of working with us to try to get our people hired, but I can tell you right now that that is the single largest impediment to success after service, is having a meaningful job, and either they're going to school to get better employment or they are getting employed. And until we absolutely make that the priority, the other problems will persist. And I think it's just we're putting salve on the wound if we don't deal with the real problem, and that is getting them employed. So I'll leave it at that and move on to what you brought me up here for. But I think there's a lot of different areas that I think we could think about and how we could get together and really think about how to better do that and how to make that a more meaningful operation, because that will reduce this population down immensely if we can get there from here. But that does take a lot more discussion, a lot more thought.
Your point is well taken. I think it is our goal collectively to get a lot more people employed.
Exactly. Not just veterans, but certainly everybody. I totally agree. So with that, speaking of jobs, this is really kind of how this came to us in the package that you have in front of you. As you'll see on it, as the discussion was talking about, housing and emergency relief shelters, et cetera, one of Clackamas County's employers, Miles Fiberglass, visited me and asked me to come visit to see what they were building based on a FEMA initiative that's going forth across the country to come up with an alternate kind of housing other than the quote-unquote FEMA trailers that we're fairly familiar with, both in the Katrina incident and also right here in Oregon up in Vernonia. So not only is that employment, but it's Oregon employment, and it certainly has, I think, some potential that we might be able to use here in Oregon for a whole host of different activities. As Paul was talking about the recovery parks, and as we've discussed that with not only you, Madam Chairman, but also other members of state government, particularly the Department of Parks,
became fairly evident to us that indeed there are some opportunities out there that we need to continue the discussions on, and indeed we need to look at a system that we can quickly, in time of a disaster, not discounting what we were talking about earlier, but certainly during a disaster, we need places that we can put people quickly. We've all talked about the fairgrounds. We've talked about other activities. There are other facilities that exist currently and how those can be modified and adjusted. But in reality, they're extremely Spartan at best. And so that may be a 24, 48-hour deal. But beyond that, what we saw in Vernonia was the last trailers moved out when, Ken, a month ago?
About 2 months ago.
So we're talking 2 years of that activity in that community. It was down to 3 or 4 trailers, but nevertheless, it's still 3 or 4 that people had to stay in there for 2 years before they could get through the process, through the bureaucracy, get their homes fixed again or get them bought out or whatever the case may be. So this is just one idea. There's several others that are out there we think that might work. What our idea was at the military department was to work with FEMA. Since they're making these purchases, we have storage facilities at Christmas Valley. That's 3 buildings that are vacant right now from the old radar site that was down there, that about probably 25,000 square foot per building. And our idea was to see if we can get FEMA to purchase these shelters. They're movable. They come in pallet sizes. We can move them with our aircraft in the military department, be CH-47 or cargo aircraft. So we could store them right here and we can have them available. They go up fairly simply, fairly easily, and they provide a lot of housing rather quickly. With 2 people can put them together. There is some infrastructure issues that we got to work through, and that was why we were looking at the state parks, is already having some of that infrastructure into certain places, as again, as evidenced in Vernonia during that flood. We used state parks to house people initially to get them under some sort of shelter. So I think it's got a lot of different components that can work very nicely for us with respect to emergency management and being able to respond to local communities. I think if you take it a step further, what we would like to see and what we've theorized at this point is that we would work with, again, state parks, look for federal grant monies through FEMA or other federal monies to build up stronger infrastructure in these facilities, and that being something of the mind that you would have water shower, potable water available, generation to provide electricity. So if everything else is disconnected, the typical state park system is not connected to sewers, but they are connected to the electrical grid, and also communication. And we would like to see that, what we would call a node, just basically a center where we could perform these emergency activities, work with the counties to help operate that. I don't see that as a state function. I see it more as a county function during an emergency. But that facility would be there, get the beds to hopefully fund it, build this. This maybe a small kitchen so we could actually provide food for those for those emergencies. And at the end of the day, when you don't have an emergency, state parks can use it for what the state parks might use it for. So I think there's some good interrelationships here that works both during an emergency and not during an emergency. So we're getting better bang for the buck. And the real issue is we would store these, and that money would sit there. That wouldn't keep generating. But other investments in state parks would generate other activities. So that's kind of the nutshell we've been working under at this point and having the discussions. There's a lot of pieces need to be put together, obviously, to make it come together. One of the requests that we're going to ask our federal delegation is we're going to come up with a model, if you will, to say we need this node, we need to build this, we need to get it constructed at least in 1 or 2 spots here on the Oregon coast is our preference because of the tsunami situation, and try to have those up and running within the next year or two as we can get federal money to do that. So we're going to be looking for an earmark. We're going to be asking our delegation to get us that funds and to do this concept and see if it, you know, take it for a test spin. So that's kind of the once over lightly. 30,000 foot, a lot of detail needs to be put at this thing right now, but that's 30,000 foot level view that we have, and I'll let Ken talk to it from his perspective as emergency manager.
Thank you. For the record, Mike.
Could I just insert a question that perhaps
Ken, you're the one that can answer. As I'm glancing at the handout while we're talking, there's just a little bit of the right-hand margin has cut off a few letters, and the critical piece is that when you were talking to me yesterday about the portability of these structures and that they could be flown somewhere in the on the bottom of the first page in a C-130 Hercules aircraft, I believe there's a number of how many of them could be transported at any one time, and I think it might have been cut off.
Madam Chair, in my haste to do some quick copying, I'll have to get back to you.
That's not critical to this discussion, but I thought maybe more generically, I don't care so much, but more than one of these can be transported at any one time, so they can be fairly quickly.
Yeah, I think what the message is on that one is with six C-130s, you could provide housing for 768 people. So they are palletized, they are transportable, they're designed.
Okay.
In our case, we don't have C-130s in Oregon. They're available, you know, throughout the West Coast.
Yeah, they can combine them.
But what we do have is we have CH-47s, which will be deploying to Afghanistan, but here in the next year. But yeah, right now we got them, and we can get more out of Washington because they have them too. And we can fly into Christmas Valley. We could pick up pallets and we could fly them into virtually any place as long as the weather provided it, which is probably a more realistic look at it. Now we could also do the C-130s and get them from other locations. So. Point being is we can move a lot of these things quickly, a whole lot quicker than you can drag trailers from Arkansas, over the highway, and we can get the things.
That basically was what I wanted to try to expand this just a little bit. And as we move into your conversation, Ken, we were talking about tsunamis. I wanted to let folks know that that's the reason Representative Boone has been forced to come and go this morning, as she's trying to cover the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Committee, where they're discussing tsunamis and her area this morning. So, again, we're crossing many spheres in these conversations.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Emergency Management Division for the Oregon Military Department. And just to stay on the tsunami, and I'll provide to the committee, we've got some information on what we're doing that OSPAC is talking about, the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Council, on an elevation project in Cannon Beach. So I will provide that to committee. It's some good information.
I think you brought that to us before, the idea of people being able to go up instead of run.
And the project is to elevate the Cannon Beach City Hall. So I will provide some new information on that. My comments will be brief. As General Caldwell had talked about, we've looked at these recovery parks, and we've obviously started from the coast and moved eastward, but in working with the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, we've tried to identify those parks based on a set of criteria, and if you'll allow me just to quickly take a look, we've looked at the hazards, the accessibility by major transportation routes, both air, water, highway, and rail. Vulnerability to potential disasters. So in numerous locations on the Oregon coast were automatically taken out because of the tsunami inundation zones. Capabilities for communications, capabilities for types of dispensaries, as General Caldwell mentioned, for medical needs. Power, self-sufficiency, those type of things. Open land, how much space is really available anywhere near a state park if we were to do this, and security issues, and then water and sewer providing convenience for those people in those parks. And I didn't bring the full packet today. In working with the Oregon Parks Department, they put together a list of all of the parks from over the entire state of Oregon, and put together a feasibility study of, you know, where the top 10, and then kind of going down the list to the ones that are lesser and lesser capable of meeting our needs. And so I think we've got some good ideas. We put together some very basic cost on some of the parks, what it might take. And you'll notice in the handout on the very back page, these shelters that are manufactured here in Oregon will even allow for a solar hookup. You'll see in the bottom right-hand corner as you look at the picture, they've displayed a solar setup. So, you know, they're compatible for any type of electricity, to include solar. And so the Parks Department put together a good matrix of what we need to deal with and how to prioritize these. And we've got a, I guess I would couch as a reasonable spread of these parks in Western Oregon and then moving towards Eastern Oregon. And we'll continue to work this out. And as General Caldwell mentioned, I think as time goes on, maybe, I'm not sure I'd couch it as low-hanging fruit, but easier to reach is to potentially work with our congressional delegation and FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security to at least get some of these and then be able to store them here where we can immediately use them. The handout that was handed out earlier shows you the basic shelter. They do come in different versions where you can house 4, 6, 8, 10 people, depending on the size of the shelter, and then connect them together in a community, as you do in some parks now where you have a public restroom, a public shower facility, and that type of thing. So each one of these dome shelters does not necessarily have all of those conveniences inside the one dome. So I think I'll conclude my remarks there. We have quite a bit of data on the state parks and what's available. We don't have everything quite flushed out, but I can share with the committee, if desired, what we know to date. And also some of the experiences that we've had, as General Caldwell talked about, in 2007, we used Stubbs Stewart State Park as part of the staging area to house people, to include inmates that were used in the support of Bernonia's cleanup. So I'll entertain any questions you have, Madam Chair.
Any specific questions?
Down here.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ken, just to clarify, make sure I understand. I assume you have budget authority to ask for the grant, or is there something we needed to stick in the February session to give you the authority to go ask the feds for the money?
Madam Chair and Senator Boquist, I have the authority to ask. What the challenge might be is a lot of the Homeland Security or FEMA grants will not allow construction or purchase of land. And so there may be some assistance that, you know, we might ask our congressional delegation to help us on in those areas.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I find this very, very interesting. So you can put them on if there is a disaster and a family loses their house but could maybe have access to their water, this could be constructed very easily.
Madam Chair, Senator Mills Anderson, I have not personally experienced it, but everybody I've talked to, these are very simple to put up, very easy to maneuver around, and you can set them up anywhere. When you go to the websites for this Miles Fiberglass and another company that co-works with them called Inner Shelter out of Alaska, you'll see pictures of these domes in the Capitol area they've used for construction security. Very simple to set up. And as you've alluded, one of the things that families really want the most after a disaster is they kind of want to be right there at their home while it's being rebuilt or redone with. And in the past, the only options, which have become elusive now after Hurricane Katrina, is a 20 to 35 foot travel trailer sitting in your parking lot. So these can be constructed very simply, just in a couple hours, and a family can live in them.
Thank you.
Yes, I just want to a little bit of a process issue here at this point, and I do apologize. It's because I'm new at the process of how you are chair of a legislative committee compared to a county committee, and I wanted to make it clear that we as the Senate body have not had any additional official
business. So I should actually close the fact that we had an open hearing and that now we are, at least our presence here is an informational session. And the reason I want to clarify that is because when one of us leaves, as was pointed out to me by my very knowledgeable vice chair, we don't have a quorum. So I wanted to clarify that for the record and assure my Senate colleagues that for us it's informational at this point. So thank you for that process, but I also want to make one comment. Miles Fiberglass and Composites is a Clackamas County company. I know those folks very, very well, and it is very nice to see them continuing to innovate in the arena of defense and emergency management in ways that are really helping our folks. So very good company, and I'm very proud of the county for having them as part of our business group. So, thank you.
Madam Chair, I might add, then Senator Schrader, I'm not sure where in the process, but it's FEMA's intent across the nation, and I know they've entertained Miles Fiberglass in coordination with InterShelter to purchase in excess of $300 million worth of these shelters and pre-stage them across the United States. I'm not sure where they're at in that process, but I'm hoping that comes to fruition and that Miles Fiberglass gets that.
And they will certainly be up to the challenge. So.
Well, that's good news for Oregon. Yeah. Representative Siegler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, I wanted to, I guess, a little bit more clarification on this process of the feasibility from the State Parks Department. Is that process completed and there are sort of various levels identified, or are they still in the process of assessing the various sites across the state?
Madam Chair and Representative Stiegler, no, they're not done. They've made some initial assessments, and we still need to work together to, really break this down into some more categories of, at least what I would couch is, what are things that are easily done right away, that maybe don't cost a lot of money, and then move it into some other categories. And I think the other piece, too, that we haven't really done is looking at if there is an additional piece of land near a park, what are the issues if the state does not own that, and some of those processes. So we're really just in the beginning stages of building a good picture of facts and figures of what we need to work with.
Follow up. I'm assuming that this will be ultimately geographically diverse as far as locales across the state. It's not just going to be...
Madam Chair, Member Siegler, yes, but based upon the type of hazard
right.
we may face.
Gotcha.
As I said earlier, some of the locations on the Oregon coast just automatically lost because of where they were setting with that beautiful view of the beach.
Hey. And then
yeah.
underwater.
Some of those parks may be marine parks when this is all done. So.
Yeah. Could be.
But the intent is to make it diverse for the entire state of Oregon so that we have options everywhere in the state of Oregon.
Good. Thank you.
The Oregon coast appreciates their challenges as well as their opportunities. process-wise, the purpose of these last two presentations were informational for the committee to sort of keep people up to date on where the discussions have gone since this concept was presented to the emergency services half of the Veterans and Emergency Services Committee on the House side. I don't foresee that there's any February legislative action required out of the breadth of the presentation today. The only potential might have been some sort of a joint resolution to encourage our federal partners to move forward on some of the housing concepts. Those sorts of resolutions are not encouraged during the short session, and I think that we have enough conversation with our federal counterparts that we can begin to move those things forward and perhaps solidify the ideas as we move into 2011 then. So, thank you, gentlemen, for coming
thank you.
Today.
Thank you.
All right.
I believe we wanted to just remind everyone what the committee schedule is for each of our committees. I guess since I'm talking, the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee during the February session will meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 1 to 3 in Hearing Room D.
Thank you, and as well, the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs will be meeting Tuesdays and Thursdays, Hearing Room B, from 3:30 to 5:30. So we'll have a busy February.
And the graveyard shift.
And the graveyard shift, too.
Yes, indeed. So. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to offer an apology to people if they've been wondering why I've been running around.
I actually told them where you were.
Oh, you
but
did.
Do you have an update that you
Well, and I've been at OSPAC upstairs, and they're giving the presentation now that I wanted to be present for about the vertical evacuation of City Hall building.
We're about to let you go.
Huh?
We'll let you go.
Yeah, I will. But I just wanted to say, and then I also had, earlier today, I just couldn't do it, a 9:30 radio show that we're going to talk about emergency preparedness issues. And so all this was happening at once, and it's literally all at once. And it was just hard to, because they're up in 357, so I've put on about 6,000 steps just moving between
good for
these
you.
Two. Yeah.
That's your exercise today.
But I just wanted to assure the people out in the presentation and audience that I am not interested. I'll be reading all this. I have been trying to keep up on it. I can't get into my phone to do this. But anyway, I apologize for being so flighty.
Okay. Thank you. And we did share with our presenters that you were doing something related to these emergency services. With that, if there's nothing else before this committee or any other comments from our good friends, the senators,
I think we can both gavel out.
We are adjourned.
Okay. Yeah.